We're talking tonight with Bill Hartung, author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. And I want to ask him, how far is too far? For example, would a company like Lockheed Martin, with their vast resources and influence, be willing to push us into a war, to encourage our country to enter a war so they could sell more product? Would they be willing to sell almost anything, even to potential adversaries of America? We'll get into some examples of that, as well as the whole Star Wars ruse. A lot of people say that that ruse by President Reagan helped us win the Cold War. In that case, then, wouldn't telling a little white lie be a good thing along the way? That and more when we come back after this break on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Hartung, when you get this big, when you get this powerful, as Lockheed Martin certainly is there anything that's off limits? Is there anything you can't get away with? And I'm specifically referring to, for example, selling to countries that might end up being our enemies. I think Japan and Germany, didn't Lockheed at some point sell some stuff to them around World War II?
Yes, in the 30s, although there was supposed to be a neutrality act that was against selling to countries at war, they managed to sell to Japan an airplane that could be easily adapted for use as a bomber. And in fact, they knew at the time that this was likely to be a problem if it came to light. They licensed not just, they didn't just sell them the plane, but the technology to build the plane. So even as we were, starting to be at war with Japan, Japan was building U.S.-designed planes to fight against us.
I guess we can't hold a current company responsible for something that was done in the 30s, but is there a more recent example?
Well, now there's a lot of unstable regimes in the world. For example, Lockheed Martin is selling to both sides of the India-Pakistan, tensions. They're selling to countries like Saudi Arabia, which, in this current climate of turmoil in the region, we don't know what kind of government is going to be there in 5 or 10 years. Is it going to be pro-U.S.? Is it going to be anti-U.S.? They were a minor supplier to the Shah of Iran, who then, when he was overthrown, the weapons came into the hands of the Islamic fundamentalist regime there. So there's been cases that they armed Greece and Turkey during the times of their, wars during the 1970s. So there's been cases, certainly. I don't think it's their, main intent, but I think if it's, if there's money there, they're willing to sort of bend those rules or, take those risks.
And find a way to do it.
Right, which may redound against us, should there be a conflict with one of these countries. They've also, they build weapons that sometimes have threatened our own troops. They build cluster bombs, which are basically, they can spread hundreds and thousands of small bomblets over an area the size of several football fields. And not only are those a danger to anybody in the proximity of them, but often those bomblets don't go off. And then they serve almost like as a landmine. And so, for example, in Iraq, some of our troops died as a result of trying to clean these things up. So, in most of these things, they've got the government with them. But, of course, they often lobby the government to come up with policies that allow these things to happen.
You mentioned in the book that that the company had sold these cluster bombs to Israel. Now, I'm trying to remember what the exact phrasing was, but was it illegal? Was there something prohibitive about that in international law that the sale wasn't supposed to go through?
Well, these weapons were not supposed to be used in any situation where they might hurt civilians. And in the case of Lebanon, for example, the southern part of the country was blanketed in cluster bombs. And so fighting itself, there were some civilians killed, but also the aftermath of the unexploded bomblets led to civilian deaths as well. So under U.S. law, weapons like that are not supposed to be used in ways that can hurt civilians. And so there was an investigation done by the State Department, which ended up just being swept under the rug. We never did find out exactly what they learned or what they decided, but nonetheless, certainly the sales to Israel have continued.
And I can't imagine what we would do if we did catch them cold. I mean, Lockheed Martin could just, thumb their noses at what are we going to do? Shut them down? That doesn't seem like a realistic threat.
No, there's really very limited things that can be done. I mean, I think there can be greater accountability. You know, there can be fines. There can be, delaying payments. There can be certainly strictures on certain kinds of exports of certain kinds of weapons. There can be, sanctions against particularly heinous regimes. I mean, thankfully, for example, there's no Lockheed Martin's weapons that have gone to Libya, for example. So you can set some limits, but I think the company has a lot of leverage on its side, certainly.
Talk to me a minute about the Star Wars episode. A lot of people would say that was a success. I mean, the Reagan administration was not entirely honest with the world, not with the American public, certainly not with the Russians, but you could say that it worked. The Russians saw that they couldn't compete with that. They collapsed. Job well done, some might say.
Well, I think a couple things. One is the, some of the influence in Russia was just its own decrepit economy, the fact that the command economy did not work. So some of the effects that brought the regime down had to do with its own inefficiencies and its own command economy. But, Robert McFarlane, who was an advisor to President Reagan, basically described Star Wars as the biggest sting operation in history, meaning that he didn't think it was going to work, but he thought if they could make them think it was going to work, it would have an influence. So along the lines of what you described, Lockheed at the time did a experiment called the homing overlay experiment, which basically involved a missile that would, the warhead of which would unfurl like a big umbrella and would therefore be in a position to block incoming warheads. And they for one of the tests, which was urgently needed because a lot of the stuff had not been working. There was some question whether we should be spending all this money on missile defense-related items. They fixed one of the tests. I mean, basically, they made the warhead easier to find. They made it double or triple the normal size. They heated it, which against the cold background of space makes it easier to find. And even with that, they barely were able to make it work. But this was kept under the rug for about 10 years, so it wasn't until after we had spent tens and hundreds of billions of dollars on these systems that it was revealed that the thing had been fixed. So, it sort of comes down to, do you think we really needed to do that, or would there have been other ways to bring the Soviet Union to its knees? And I think another aspect was the Gorbachev regime, who he tried to kind of make some changes there in the edifice, and basically the changes that he tried to make just brought it down sooner than it might have otherwise been, because it was kind of this giant with feet of clay that, really was not able to compete in the modern information age.
Is the list a long one of this company in particular, defense contractors in general, starting a program, spending big chunks of money, billions of dollars, and then it gets canceled and that's the end of it and nobody ever mentions it again?
It's a short list. I mean, the F-22 is an example, although, as I said, it was complicated by the fact that they got money for another program in similar amounts to what they lost. But there's been many attempts to stop systems like the B-1 bomber, the Osprey, which is an aircraft that's supposed to function both as a conventional aircraft and as a helicopter. Things like this. The Osprey was canceled by Dick Cheney and a member of Congress named Kurt Weldon, who had it built in his district, basically teamed up with the Marines to get this thing reinstated in the budget. In the B-1 case, Rockwell International, the lead contractor, basically after the Carter administration had canceled it, got it to pop up again as a major system funded by the Reagan administration. So, there's only a handful of examples where these attempts to cancel systems that the government has indicated they don't need have been successful. Often the lobby can just reverse those government decisions by using their economic clout, their political clout.
You make the point in the book, Profits of War, that a lot of people who've worked for high executive positions for Lockheed Martin then go to work in some high position within the government. They can lobby on behalf of the, in a very subtle way, lobby on behalf of programs while they're there, and then they go back to work for Lockheed. Is that common or uncommon?
Well, the revolving door, as they call it, where it sort of runs both ways. You have people going from the companies into government where they can help their former employer. You also have them coming out of government and working for the companies. So it sort of spins both ways. But in a given year, when they've done real investigations, sometimes as many as 2,000 people go back and forth between the industry in the government. So it's a huge cohort. And then there was a recent report study by the Boston Globe, a report named Brian Bender, which found that of admirals and generals who had gone left the government in recent years, you know, about 80% of them went straight to work for defense companies or set up their own defense consulting firm. So it's kind of the rule rather than the exception that this kind of thing happens.
Talk to me about the idea of people either in the company or from the company in government at a given time lobbying for a war, suggesting, yeah, let's go, let's invade Iraq, let's go into Afghanistan. Because I would assume that a 10-year-long conflict like Afghanistan, and now 8 years since we started in Iraq, represents billions of dollars for a company like Lockheed Martin. Would they lobby on this on the behalf of profits for their company as opposed to our national interest?
Well, there was a vice president at Lockheed Martin named Bruce Jackson, who was part of the Project for the New American Century, which included people like Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney. And in the late 90s, they already were lobbying for regime change in Iraq, for intervention in Iraq. And then when they became influential members of the Bush administration, they carried out, you know, that plan, that impulse that they had, you know, sort of pushed for when they were out of government. So you had Bruce Jackson, who was actually the head of that organization. He then went on also to be the co-chair of the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, which was formed at the behest of the Bush administration to help market the Iraq war in the 6 months before we actually intervened there. So certainly there's evidence of companies in personnel. And then, of course, they have funded think tanks that lobbied for intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan, for more money for missile defense, for things like, you know, a more aggressive nuclear policy that involved building greater nuclear weapons infrastructure, new kinds of nuclear weapons, all of which in one degree or another have benefited the company.
Well, I guess it's hard to see what is in someone's heart for sure to say what their true motives are, because the names that you listed are certainly true believers. They said publicly many, many times that they saw Iraq as a threat. They said they believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. They needed us to go in. So I guess it's hard to say for sure whether they were thinking of national security or the bottom line for the company.
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of motives. You know, I think certainly there were some true believers who felt this was the thing to do. And then I think you have people like Lockheed Martin executive in the mix, who I think was more concerned in exploiting those concerns and those fears to promote policies that would help the company. So I think there's never kind of a pure example or pure motives. There's always a mix of motives and a mix of individuals with different motives.
When you look at something like Afghanistan, which has no end in sight, do you see the hand of Lockheed Martin? I mean, I know they're not selling any, they're not using any F-22s over there, but I got to guess they've got something that's being used and is adding to their bottom line. Do you see their hand in prolonging something like that?
Well, they are involved in gathering intelligence for the Predator drone strikes, mostly in Pakistan. The missiles that are used for those strikes, the Hellfire, are Lockheed Martin missiles. They have a contract under which they funded a network of companies that was involved in sending special forces and private intelligence operatives into Pakistan, kind of violating their pledges to the Pakistani government and the own U.S. government's own internal regulations about what you would use these private contractors to do, because basically they were gathering intelligence. They were part of an assassination hit squad that worked within the country. So they were doing everything and more that a U.S. government employee would do. So you've got this kind of runaway factor where you've got companies operating, basically doing things that should be the job of government in ways that profit their company. So it's gotten out of hand to a great degree, and Lockheed Martin is one of the elements of that, not the only one.
We have more American contractors than American soldiers in Afghanistan, right?
Yes, as was the case in Iraq. And some of them are, you know, literally involved in combat-related operations. Some of them do things like build military bases, supply, you know, food and logistics, repair vehicles. So it's a whole gamut of activities. But what it means is that to some degree, at least in the logistics area, it's hard for the government to go to war now without these private contractors, many of whom at the higher up level make 5 and 10 times as much as our troops that are doing the same work.
Tell me this. What's your take on the Libya situation, our involvement there? I know we shot off like 112 Tomahawk cruise missiles. I think they cost $500,000 each, or maybe more than that. It's a lot of money for a one-day missile spree on our part. Do you see the hand of, if not Lockheed Martin, I don't think that's the company that makes the Tomahawks, but you see the hand of somebody else in there?
Well, I think it's primarily an issue of exerting U.S. influence in a case where there was a genuine concern about this regime, you know, slaughtering its own people. But, you know, regardless of the motive, the company certainly will benefit, you know, because, as you said, these missiles, this ordnance, these planes are immensely costly. So, you know, what sounded like a simple matter, you know, a no-fly zone over Libya, I think is going to cost, you know, billions and billions of dollars. So I haven't seen any evidence that the companies have lobbied for this. They'll certainly be on the receiving end of a lot of the money that it'll take to carry it out.
You mentioned Lockheed Martin's involvement in a variety of little national security work, anti-terror work, the Predator, and various other drones. You mentioned this in the book. One of the involvements of the company is in surveillance, working with the NSA. And I think of all the things that you mention in the book, and there's a lot of spooky, disturbing stuff. That's what bothers me more than anything, is working with the NSA on who knows what kind of a surveillance program. I'm sure that they will promise that it doesn't target American citizens, but I'm not sure I believe those kind of promises anymore. And the fact that you have a private company with even less accountability to the public and to Congress worries me.
Well, the whole role of private companies in the intelligence agencies has become quite extensive. In fact, there's a book called Spies for Hire by a journalist named Tim Shorrock, which shows that there are now more private contractors in the NSA and the CIA than there are government employees. So they do things like, you know, run the spy satellites. They prepare, in some cases, the daily intelligence brief that the president uses to assess threats around the world. You know, they're involved in every aspect of intelligence and information gathering. And so, you know, the NSA has in the past been caught doing things that involve intercepting phone calls and internet activity of U.S. citizens, always under the guise of fighting terrorism, but nonetheless violating the privacy of American citizens. So, you know, for example, there was a Pentagon program called the Counterintelligence Field Activity, which was spying on people within the country, including some anti-war protesters. And Congress shut that thing down, but as far as Shorrock could tell, it was transferred to the NSA. So a lot of these things are very hard to ride herd over, especially when they're located within the intelligence community.
It makes you wonder when, if we'll ever find out about this stuff. It might be 10 or 15 or 20 years down the line, too late to raise hell with anyone.
It's very hard with these intelligence operations. I mean, even the revelations of the 70s, when there was quite active investigations by people like Senator Frank Church, many things they were talking about had happened in the late 50s and the 60s, and they weren't uncovering them until the mid-70s. So I think you're right. There is that when there's that cloak of secrecy, it's very hard to know what our government is up to until, you know, sometimes years later when people involved write memoirs, come clean, have second thoughts about what they've been involved in.
Bill Hartung is my guest. He's the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Real curious what the reaction from the company has been, if there's been a reaction. Have they hired hit squads to take Bill out for publishing this book? We'll get into that and more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Bill Hartung, author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. One of the examples mentioned in the book is this program called the C-5, a gigantic transport plane, the C-5. And a friend of mine sent me a note that said that in military circles, the C-5 was known by an acronym, a nickname, FRED, which stood for Blanking Ridiculous Expenditure of Dollars. And at Travis Air Force Base, they used to serve a FRED burger. until the powers that be didn't want that term Fred used anywhere officially, so it went away. We'll get into that and a lot more. I want to ask Bill Hartung if he's had a reaction from Lockheed Martin. A company that big certainly can't be happy about this kind of pointed criticism, and you have to wonder if they would come after him in some way. We'll get into that, and if we got time, we'll take a couple of your questions for my guest Bill Hartung here on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Hartung, has there been a reaction from Lockheed Martin since your book came out?
Well, it's interesting. Not as much as I would have expected. A reporter from Politico had interviewed me and asked the company, you know, their thoughts about the book. And the first thing they said is that they were disappointed in me for not talking to them. But, of course, I had reached out to them many, many times, and they had refused to talk to me. So that was kind of a little spin control. And then they made sort of a blanket statement that, you know, there were many, many inaccuracies in the book. But they never actually came out and said what they thought they were. And I think that's because, you know, everything in the book is documented from government sources, sometimes from the company's own sources, from, you know, reputable places. So I don't think they really wanted to go toe-to-toe on accuracy. And I think somebody decided, well, you know, we're big enough. This is not going to make a dent. Let's just let this thing blow over. And so I think they were afraid if they came out, you know, strong and public against it, it would draw more attention to the book. So it's kind of a more of a stealth strategy that I've witnessed.
Do you have any hope that there could be a positive reaction to it, that someone in Congress, for example, would pay attention, or someone in the administration, and say, hey, this needs to be fixed?
I do. I think in the Congress there are members who, you know, they're aware of some of this kind of lobbying, but maybe not the extent of it, not the other activities the company's engaged in. There was a case at the time of the merger subsidies where Representative Bernie Sanders helped claw back some of the money that had been intended for executive bonuses, you know, taxpayer dollars subsidizing executive bonuses. There were some members who stood up against the F-22. So I think, although a minority, I think there might be some people taking some leadership and trying to fix some aspects of the problem. I think the book might be you know, helpful to some of them.
How do you fix it? And I'm not just talking about with Lockheed Martin. I look at the control, the influence of other industries within our government, you know, big agriculture, big pharma, big health companies, big oil, as much as anyone, how they are able to control the dialogue. You know, they'll take out ads in a local congressional district and ask the voters to call a congressional office and go for one way or another. They lobby in D.C. They spread a lot of money. They give campaign money that buys them influence. If you don't go along with them, they fund somebody else to run against you. Because of the Supreme Court ruling, they have basically unlimited spending in political campaigns. You know, you look at variety of big issues. At worst, these great gigantic conglomerates can get a stalemate and not change anything, and call it, if you want, corporate welfare, whether it's in the form of tax breaks for big oil or outright subsidies for growing corn for ethanol, and at best, you get everything you want. I just wonder if that is a fixable situation.
Well, I think, you know, we need some smart lawyers to figure out if there's some way to limit the campaign money or to give a fair chance to people who are not taking corporate money. You know, I think there's got to be some limits on the revolving door where it's so easy for these companies to send people in and out of the government. I think, you know, there's been some talk about if you leave, making you wait 2, 3, or more years before you can lobby your former associates. So, you know, I think there's the money. I think there's the revolving door. I think there's the government being more firm on things like cost overruns, making the companies, you know, pick up more of the tab for that. I think there's transparency where, you know, we should know when the money's coming from these companies, when they fund things like think tanks and, you know, issue-oriented groups and so forth. But it's definitely an uphill struggle. You know, I think, you know, it's sort of like, could you organize a citizen force that could go to toe-to-toe with some of these interests? And I think, you know, maybe through internet fundraising, maybe through some citizen leadership, there might be a way to create some counterbalance to some of these things. But there's no question it's a huge, you know, issue for our democracy, and it's going to take a lot of people, you know, thinking and working hard to figure out the best ways to address it.
So you would say it is not a threat to say it is a genuine danger to democracy itself?
Well, I think it is a danger, but I think we still have enough, you know, freedom to try to address it. And I think it's just going to take some hard thinking, some hard work, some creative thinking to figure out the best strategies for doing that.
One other question I want to ask you, then we'll take a couple from the listeners. It's about NASA. You mentioned in passing that Lockheed Martin has done some stuff for NASA, is doing some stuff for NASA. I wrote about this thing called, read about this thing called Plymouth Rock, where they want to send NASA, I mean, Lockheed Martin proposed this mission to an asteroid where you'd send a team, a two-person or three-person team to an asteroid, gather some samples and come back. And boy, wouldn't that be great for figuring out how we can protect ourselves from an asteroid smashing into Earth. And it really looks like something that you'd spend a couple of billion dollars on, and then it would just go away.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. NASA, they've done some interesting projects. They've done projects that, you know, for exploring Mars. They've done, you know, they did a attempt to do an alternative to the space shuttle, which has recently been scaled back. You know, I think there's a mixture of kind of boondoggles and you know, useful projects, and it's, I'd say, much more mixed their record with NASA than, say, with the Pentagon, that they have done some interesting things that may have some, you know, some benefits.
Not to single out Lockheed Martin too much. I guess they're the biggest, or you would have written about somebody else in your book, but it's not just them, is it? There's other companies doing the same thing on just a lesser scale?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's companies like Northrop Grumman, like Boeing, and Boeing has actually had probably more scandals in recent years than Lockheed Martin has. There's General Dynamics, there's Raytheon, there's probably, you know, really about a big five that are the biggest influence, you know, in the defense industry. Lockheed Martin is, you know, head and shoulders above the others, but the others certainly are pushing in the same direction, doing some self-dealing and doing some of the same lobbying techniques.
Let's take a couple of calls. My guest is Bill Hartung, author of Prophets of War. I'm hoping our questions deal with Lockheed Martin and this whole sort of genre that we've been talking about this evening. West of the Rockies, Gary in Salton Sea, California. Hi, Gary.
How are we doing this morning?
Okay.
I don't know if it was you that mentioned one time when you had somebody on there and they said something about a flying aircraft carrier.
It wasn't me, but we can ask Bill Hartung if he's heard about anything like that.
Okay, because I lived out at the Salton Sea, you know, since the 70s, and they have a flyway out there. It's a military experimental flyway. It's down in the area of Nyland, which is about 15 miles from the North Shore area where I live, okay? And in the 70s, when I was out by Dos Palmas in a ranch area out there, I looked up in the sky and I seen this thing coming very slow, 5-10 miles an hour, pretty good size. And I thought, what in the heck is this thing? And on each wing coming out of the structure of this aircraft looking structure was three engines on the front, three engines on the back side of the one wing, three engines on the front and the rear of the other side of the wing, dual propellers on each engine. And now I know that this guy must know about some of these engines and propellers and stuff. They like work against each other.
Well, let's ask him. Bill, as you develop sources to write this book and other books, have you had some glimpses about other things that might be in the pipeline, exotic aircraft? I know we've had a lot of reports over the last 10, 15 years about these giant triangles that seem to be some sort of observation platforms that are seen most often around Air Force bases. Anything like that or what our caller has described?
Well, I've never heard of anything like a flying aircraft carrier. But there are some interesting twists. They're working with the Kamen Corporation to try to make a pilotless helicopter. They've got among companies that have tried to make nanotechnology, you know, small kind of swarming, either for surveillance or for attack mode. There's some kind of, you know, throwback technology. They have a large surveillance balloon that's been seen in Afghanistan that hovers over an area to do surveillance and information gathering. And you know, there are companies working on things like a space plane, which has had its ups and downs, but, you know, would look like an aircraft and would be able to go into orbit. And, of course, there's the Advanced Research Project Agency at the Pentagon, which does, you know, all kinds of secret research on things that, you know, we don't know about yet. So there's no question that there's a lot of kind of exotic and interesting things in the pipeline, but I haven't heard of anything like the notion of a flying aircraft carrier.
Gary, thanks for that call. What about HAARP? Is there a Lockheed Martin connection to HAARP? We deal with a lot of conspiracies on the program. I don't know if you hear Coast to Coast have heard it before, but HAARP comes up a lot. And in internet chatter over the last couple of weeks, some people even blame HAARP for the Japanese earthquake, as preposterous as that might seem. Is there a connection between HAARP and Lockheed?
Not that I know of, no.
Okay. Wildcard line, Christian in Los Angeles. Hi, Christian.
Oh, hello, guys.
Howdy.
Yes, hi.
Yeah, oh, hi. I've called on your show a couple of times. I have a quick question, and that is, I'm in the midst of studying the Kennedy assassination, because as you guys know, in 2 years, it's going to be the 50th anniversary of that infamous day in Dallas. And Oliver Stone seems to point out in his film, and he also supports this heavily, that the military-industrial complex may have been part of the Kennedy assassination because, as you know, Kennedy did not want to get involved in a war in Southeast Asia. In fact, that summer in 63, he was putting together the final touches to what was National Security Action Memorandum 272, which pretty much said that if Kennedy was reelected, that sometime in his early term, in his second term, that he would pull the troops out of Vietnam. I think by early 65, the process would have been completed. So I've wondered that, you know, if I think if they may actually have been in part of or have supported the, you know, the assassination of JFK, because remember, I mean, JFK was, you know, a threat to the establishment. And of course, you know, if you pull the troops out of Vietnam, you can forget your defense contracts. So that's my question for you guys, and thank you very much.
I'm not a big fan of that theory. I mean, I think, you know, that you could see kind of a argument, but I think Stone's movie works better as a kind of quasi-fictionalized account than anything that would have happened in reality.
I guess maybe the question should be, would you put it past, maybe not necessarily just Lockheed Martin, but these great big giant defense contractors, if they were asked to participate in some sort of an assassination, maybe not the JFK, but say Diem in Vietnam or somebody in some backwater country, would they do it?
Well, you know, so far those kinds of things have been done, you know, by government operatives, CIA agents and you know, people that they kind of run in the field. But now that you've got, you know, companies like Lockheed Martin doing things like helping run these assassination networks in Pakistan, which, of course, are aimed at the Taliban and the like, so they're not against foreign leaders. But I suppose, you know, God forbid we get to the point where our government wanted to do that kind of thing again. You could have a company mixed up in it just because they're so involved in intelligence and related activities. I don't, you know, hope to see it. I don't think it's likely, but it's not, I suppose, not impossible.
I would imagine you got a lot of people listening who would say, good, if the government has hired contractors working for Lockheed Martin or whomever, and they're going in and killing al-Qaeda leaders and taking out the Taliban and cutting off the head, good.
Well, I think it's kind of a question of whether once you accept that kind of thing, can it be abused? You know, could it be used against people who are not Taliban? Do you have bad intelligence, end up killing people who are, you know, unrelated, including maybe civilians? How does it affect your relationship with the host government, which has asked that these things not be done on their soil? So there's a lot of complications to it. But I could certainly see how some people would say, "What, you know, whatever it takes to get these folks should be done." You know.
Try to get one more call in east of the Rockies, Bruce in Indiana, Pennsylvania. Hi, Bruce. Good morning.
Good morning. By the way, I'm a big fan of yours.
Thanks.
Since we're dropping missiles all over Libya, so hard for us to just sort of swing around Africa and start cleaning up the piracy in Somalia and stuff like that. I'll take this off the line.
Okay. Is there a weapon system that Lockheed Martin has or anybody else, Bill Hartung, that you can think of that would work for the pirates?
Well, I think that the problem is, you could, as Secretary Gates has pointed out, some Navy SEALs and a combat ship could, in some cases, deal with this. The problem with weapons, offensive weapons, is what happens to the hostages. And I don't think anybody's figured out how to get around that. So I think it's either negotiations or assaults on the ships, which can be done with, without a lot of high-tech equipment.
I saw that you were on C-SPAN on a program with David Eisenhower talking about your book, and he'd written a similar book. Did you ask him about what his grandfather, did he have any insight into what his grandfather meant with that warning about the military-industrial complex?
Well, he pretty much endorsed some of the arguments in a new book by a journalist named James Ledbetter called Unwarranted Influence, which is about the genesis of the speech. And Ledbetter talked about things like the bomber lobby, like the use of advertising. I think there was also the whole missile gap thing where there was leaked information, which turned out to be false, that somehow there was a missile gap and the Soviet Union was way ahead of us. And when Kennedy came in, it ended up, in fact, we were far ahead of them. So he felt like data had been manipulated to make him look like he was soft on defense. Then that was used against Nixon in the 60 campaign to say, well, as part of the Eisenhower administration, he had presided over a dangerous gap in our defenses. So I think that was another piece of it. And David Eisenhower, really didn't refute any of that, seemed to be, kind of in line with that. These were the kinds of things anyway that, prompted the speech.
Oh, one other question for you. Are you optimistic? I mean, you described the kinds of changes that would be necessary to turn this around. Are you optimistic that they could happen?
Well, I tend to be an optimist, which is why I do this work. I mean, I think it would be too depressing to do if I thought there was no hope. But as I said, I think it'd take a lot of work. And it'd take what Eisenhower called an alert and knowledgeable citizenry, which I think in our current climate, where there's a lot of distractions, people worried about just making a living, there's celebrity journalism, there's so many other things people could focus on, then sort of basic responsibilities of citizenry, that I think that's also a challenge. How do you get people to focus on some of these important issues when there's so many other things, so much other information, overload and so forth?
Well, Bill Hartung, thank you for coming on the program. Prophets of War is the book. I recommend it. Hope you enjoyed yourself.
Yes, I really appreciate the chance to be on the show.
Excellent. Come back and see us sometime, especially if Lockheed comes knocking at your door. And we would like to extend an invitation to Lockheed Martin as well. We don't want to make this totally one-sided. If somebody wants to come on and talk to us about this, we're glad to have you on the program. Coming up, we shift gears here. Rahasia Poe is my guest to talk about his book, To Believe or Not to Believe, The Social and Neurological Consequences of Belief Systems. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.